are sacrosanct. And that we, they don't say, you will not be able to think otherwise. They say they are true. They are the truth. You see? And that is the same function as the hypnotic suggestion put into us ever since we were receptive children. So naturally, it's all part of the conspiracy which we are playing on ourselves. We can't blame our parents for this, because their parents played it on them. And they bought it. And don't forget that time goes backwards. You see? You can't blame this on the past. Because now in the present, you are creating the values of the past. And you are buying them all along, see? So there's no out on this. You see, in a way, psychoanalytically, one is given an out by saying, well, the parents didn't bring up their children properly. And American people are consumed with guilt about the way they bring up their children. So we must abandon completely the notion of blaming the past for any kind of situation we're in. And reverse our thinking and see that the past always flows back from the present, that now is the creative point of life. And so, you see, it's like the idea of forgiving somebody. You change the meaning of the past by doing that. It's like also when you watch the flow of music. The melody, as it is expressed, is changed by notes that come later. Just as the meaning of a sentence, especially, say, take German or Latin, where there's the convention of placing a verb at the end of a sentence. You wait, in other words, till later to find out what the sentence means, according to our way of feeling it. So it is also in our language, if I say I love you, you don't know when I've said I, what I is doing. I could say I hate you. So we don't know until later. So in other words, the word love or the word hate changes the function of the word I. And then I was going to say, I love flowers. No, but I love you. You see? And so the word later changes the meaning of those that go before. The present is always changing the past. So, when you get the idea in your mind that the point of view I'm talking about is very difficult indeed to acquire, that idea is one you are putting there to stop yourself seeing the other point of view. And above all, you must not take that seriously. It is simply a method of postponing seeing the point now. So you have to see it now or never, because there is only now. If you say, well, tomorrow, the next day, maybe in another dozen lifetimes, I'll be ready. That means, simply and solely, I don't want to be bothered with it now. I'm even not interested in it now, so I've got an excuse for putting it off. Which is fine, that's perfectly okay. You can put it off. There is no reason, there is no compulsion why you should come out of this illusion. That's why Oriental people do not tend in the same way as Westerners to be missionaries and saying it's very urgent that you be saved. It isn't, unless you say so. I mean, unless you are so disturbed by the suffering and the problem of suffering that you've got to find some sort of escape. But if you don't want to, you can stay there. It's okay, there's lots of time. And maybe you'll see through it when you die. At least in the moment of death, you'll see that it was all a fake. So, don't be scared about the idea of the difficulty of it. That's a red herring, and it's quite irrelevant. And I don't think that teachers should talk quite so much about this as they do, and saying, oh, this is going to take a long, long time and a lot of practice and many years. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But that's beside the point. Because it distracts. It's like telling somebody that this is a very difficult book to read and it requires immense powers of concentration. Well, that immediately kills your interest in it. Instead of if I would say, well, now this is a most extraordinary book. This is so fascinating. I've been working on it for years, and every time I just get so involved, I can't drop the thing. No? I mean, that's a far more encouraging attitude to a student than, well, it's going to be very difficult. Except to very, very self-hating students who somehow perversely enjoy suffering through it. I suppose that's, of course, a way too, but all right, now, if we can see the first part, which is that the ego is purely fictitious, that it is a symbol or image of oneself, plus a sensation of muscular strain occasioned by trying to make this symbol an effective agent, to control emotion, to concentrate, to direct the nervous operations of the organism. Then immediately it is clear that what we have called ourselves, what we have thought of as ourselves, isn't able to do anything at all. There follows this kind of silence, in which there is nothing to do except watch what happens. But what is happening is watching itself. There is nobody apart from it watching it. And so we get into the state of meditation, or as I prefer to call it, contemplation. So then the next problem that arises is, well, what about all the other illusions? Although they are somehow integrated and centered upon the illusion of ego, nevertheless, the whole value system of what is important, what is not important, what is good, what is bad, what is pleasant, what is painful, has to be called in question. Not in order to destroy the whole value system, but in order to see it for what it is. And that's where we will object and say, well, surely that's a colossally difficult task because we are so long habituated to it. And we have been taught to believe that the longer we have been habituated to something, the more difficult it is to change it. And that is true if you believe it. And if you don't, it isn't. So that's why it's always emphasized, at any rate in Zen, that when anything is to be done, it should be done immediately, without thinking it over in advance. Act at once. And you find that characteristic of people trained in Zen. They always act immediately. They don't say, well, when should we do this sort of thing? They just do it. Because that doesn't build up. It gives no time for the building up of all this reflection of, well, I've done this way for a long time and I really feel kind of draggy about doing it another way. Yeah, it's like some people eat the same thing every day. And the idea of suddenly eating something else seems absolutely weird. I remember when I used to have lunch in London, in the city of London. I used to go to their rather fancy sandwich bar. And there was a very square young man in a derby hat who ordered exactly the same lunch every day. Fantastic. And so it came that the man who served the bar, the moment he saw him coming in at the door, he had it there. And he would have had a real qualm if somebody had suggested that instead of having a beef sandwich, he should have a smoked salmon one. Now then, we get to this. What we are aware of is a complex of vibrations. And we have been conditioned to call them graduatingly good, bad, pleasant, painful. Whereas, as a matter of fact, they are nothing but vibrations. And if you look at any one of them by itself, you won't know where it is. That is to say, if you only know red, you can't see that it's red. You could only know that this is red by contrast with yellow and green and blue and violet. So you don't know that a sound is loud unless you know soft sounds. Or you don't know that it's soft unless you know loud. And it is that comparison which gives us the feeling of the spectrum as being varied. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. For example, when you watch television, you are actually seeing a single moving point moving over the screen. But it goes so fast that you see it in all these different places having different values of light. But let us supposing there was someone whose retina was not retentive in this way. He would look at the screen and see the moving point of light and say to human beings, I don't see what you see in this. Now can we, therefore, get back not only to the situation where we see that the ego is a mere construct, but also where we see that all the values we put on the vibrations are arbitrary. And that we get to a position where we see the vibrations simply as the vibrations. And we would say then, well, surely all this is nonsense. Which is correct. The universe, I mean, is a kind of ba-doo-dee-da, 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 going on in this fantastic way. This is why music can be used as a meditative technique. Because a lot of music is nonsense. It doesn't mean anything. But it can be very interesting. So can you get back again to recollecting from childhood your pleasure in events that from your present point of view you would call entirely meaningless? That you could listen to a sound like a twanging metal and it goes boing, 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 and that's fascinating. Boing. It's just boing. And that's all it is. See? Now if you can really get with boing, see? You can see the whole universe in boing. Really? Because every vibration that's possible implies all the others. And so, likewise, with a candle flame, with a reflection, with grain in wood, anything can, from this child point of view, be completely fascinating. Not because it means anything, but just for what it is, that it is shaped so. There was a joke in Punch some time ago, many years ago, I remember, of an army doctor interviewing a private. And the private says, "Every time I shake my leg like this, it hurts." He said, "God damn it, don't shake it." But you know, when one has something that hurts, there's a subtle temptation to keep worrying it. Like if you have a filling out of a tooth, your tongue plays with the empty hole. And children will experiment with pain in this way. It's like a dare. Children are always playing the game of daring each other to do something forbidden. Because the risk of disapproval involved, the calamity that may follow from it, it makes it so exciting. And why on earth do people challenge disaster the way they do, doing all sorts of wildly adventurous things? Because obviously that gives a taste, a quality to a vibration that is extremely interesting. Why the craving for speed? So on. And it's only if you look very carefully at a vibration that you can see this point. That's why meditative exercises often involve a repetition process. Om, or saying a phrase, or doing an act like a mudra, over and over and over again. After a while, it becomes meaningless. You can say your own name, like the Sufis do, and go on and on and on and on and on, and finally, it doesn't mean anything at all. It's just a noise. But it isn't just a noise, you see. The attitude of saying that something is just a noise, or just a wiggle, is an adult attitude. No wiggle to the child is just a wiggle. To the child, the elemental thing going on is blah, you know, I mean, it's just fantastic. Now, do you see why this is what mystics call ineffable? That is to say, you can't really talk about it. When I try to explain what I mean by digging a sound, I suddenly realize that I'm not really saying anything. And yet there are states of consciousness in which you can listen to sound and realize that that is the whole point of being alive. Just to go with this particular energy manifestation that is happening right at this moment. To be it. The whole world is the energy playing at doing all this, you see, like a kaleidoscope, jazzing. So if you watch that, and watch it that way, you will be accused, of course, by those who are guardians of the game of doing something very dangerous. But you're going completely crazy. I mean, the number of theological texts I've read which express in one way or another this horror of everything becoming meaningless, the meaningless life, tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Those people, you see, have not dared to look at it.